going back in time and into cookbooks to explore Maine's rich food heritage. When you think of iconic Maine foods, what do you think of? Lobster rolls? Blueberry pie? Potatoes? What about the Italian sandwich? Fish chowder? Corn chowder? Sardines? Fiddleheads? Bean hole beans? B&M beans? Moxie? The list goes on and on. And it's a good illustration of just how varied and rich Maine's food traditions are from one end of the state to the other. And that includes food from cultures that are newer to Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. A new exhibit at the Maine Historical Society celebrates the state's culinary might. It's called Maine Eats. The Food Revolution Starts Here. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn more about the exhibit and more about Maine's food heritage from three food historians. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio Studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What do you think when you think about Maine and food? What comes to mind? Lobster rolls and blueberry pie are probably up there. But today, Maine food ranges from sushi rolls to Somali cuisine. We have a rich and varied food history here, which is still evolving. And food has become a huge part of Maine's culture, reputation, and economy. Joining me now to talk about some of the many different types of food found in our state and our food heritage, Sandy Oliver. She's a food writer and historian and writes a column for the Bangor Daily News. Don Lindgren is the proprietor of Rabelais, an antiquarian bookstore in Biddeford that specializes in food and drink. And Nancy Harmon Jenkins is an award-winning cookbook author and food historian whose food expertise ranges from Maine to the Mediterranean. You can see Nancy in action making a Maine maple bread pudding. Ah, my tummy just grumbled here just saying that. A Maine maple bread pudding on our new Maine Public Out and About video. You can find that on our website and our Facebook page. It was posted this morning. So watch Nancy make that and then try it yourself. As always, we want to hear from you. What is your family's favorite Maine dish? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Before we talk to the guests in the studio, though, we're going to turn to Tilly Lasky. She's with the Maine Historical Society. She curated the new exhibit there called Maine Eats. Tilly joins us by phone. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for having me.
So I got to see the exhibit this morning, and I want to ask you why Maine Historical Society chose the topic of food for its new exhibit.
Sure. We chose food for a few reasons. First off, you know, food is a human universal. If we don't eat, we will die. And so it's immediately relevant to everybody. You know, all of our visitors coming in will be able to find themselves somewhere in that exhibit. And historically, Maine's identity, culture, and economy have all been tied to food, everything from fishing and agriculture to today's award-winning chefs. So it's something that's relevant and today, and we can find those ties to history.
The ties to history. One of the things that I thought was so interesting are the ties to the Wabanaki influence on Maine foods. I think a lot of people know that Native Americans grew corn, but there are other iconic Maine foods that the Wabanaki first grew or harvested, correct?
Sure. We have Passamaquoddy maple story is highlighted in the exhibit, and they started in 2013, and they've got an amazing harvesting maple syrup harvesting situation in Jackman, and they're doing really great. And it's a way for them to express culturally something that they've done for millennia and economically for it to help the tribe.
So before I let you go, I have to ask you, do you have a favorite Maine food or dish?
Oh, crab meat has to be my favorite.
And how do you like, just straight, or do you have a dish that you make with crab meat?
Oh, my mom used to make the best crab meat sandwiches, and I lived in Colorado for a few years, and every time I'd get on the plane home, she'd send me with one.
Oh, well, that sounds like a nice mom. Thanks, Tilly. Tilly Lasky, the curator of the Maine Eats exhibit at the Maine Historical Society, where she is the outreach curator. And I ought to mention that part of the exhibit are people's personal stories. This is tied in with the Maine Memory Network's project to collect a whole bunch of stories around the state. And we'll post information about that on our Maine Calling Facebook page. So, Sandy, I'm going to start with you. Maine is known for certain products, of course, blueberries and lobsters and potatoes. What are some of the key elements that shaped Maine's food heritage, other than the weather?
Yeah, the sea, and interestingly enough, poverty. Would you like me to tell you more about that?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, the sea is obvious. We settled first along the coast, and actually, the coast was visited much earlier than settlement by European fishermen coming here with their catches of cod to lay out on fish flakes to dry before they took them back to Europe. But because Maine was sort of tucked up in a corner, and we lagged a little behind the rest of New England in our economic development, so a lot of the old ways kind of stuck with us a lot longer because there wasn't the prosperity to support adopting all kinds of new stuff. So
we were cooking farm to table and nose to tail before it was trendy, but when we had to.
Yes, when we had to, sure.
Sure. So what was once because we were poor is now...
It became part of our tradition, sure.
Nancy, what do you think are some of the unsung heroes of Maine's food culture? I'm talking in terms of ingredients. We hear about potatoes, blueberries, lobster.
Yeah, I think that that's all featured in the Maine Historical Society exhibit, and I think that's a really good beginning. But boy, there are so many more things here. And I think of both things that, in terms of the sea, things that we've adopted now, like mussels and squid, which, you know, in my mother's kitchen were never allowed. Even cod was banned from my mother's kitchen.
Mussels, squid, and cod?
Yeah.
You couldn't eat when you were growing up?
Not cod, she said, because it was wormy. A lot of people ate cod, but not my mother was kind of a snob about her food.
Isn't that ironic?
Yeah.
Because that you'll find cod on the menus of the finest restaurants in the world now.
Exactly. But that's deep water cod. It's inshore cod that's often wormy. I'm told that by fishermen. I don't have any personal experience of it at all. But, you know, I think about things like that this time of year. I think about dandelion greens, because as soon as the snow melts, those dandelions are going to start coming up. And dandelion greens are one of those great... Sandy was talking about poverty food, foraging for food. And not just dandelion greens, but cowslip greens, marsh marigold greens, and fiddlehead greens, of course. We had a little discussion about that earlier. I'm not sure that fiddlehead greens was such a strong tradition as they are nowadays, but they certainly are nowadays.
Sandy's shaking her head. She's agreeing with you.
Yeah. Oh, and then up on in the St. John River Valley, where the French-American community is very strong, they have this green called poulet grass, they call it. And it's a goose foot. It's a kinopodium, and it's a wild green. And they make a soup au poulet grass, a la poulet grass, I guess it should be. And it's just a wonderful basic chicken stock with a lot of wild, fresh greens in it that you need at this time of year, because my mother always said, you've got to get some iron in your blood, and that's where you get it from. And truly, these greens they do have a lot of iron in them.
Okay. How do you cook dandelion greens? I've never had the courage.
Oh, God.
When the dandelions come up all over my yard, what do I do?
Well, you get out and you dig them before they start to form flowers, before that little stalk comes up with a blossom on it. Because once that happens, then they start to turn bitter. But if you get them when they're very young, you have to wash them for about 6 hours over and over again. Not literally, but close to that.
Fill up the sink with cold water and plunge them.
Yeah, and then fill it up again and plunge them, and again and again and again until you don't have any dirt coming off them at all. And then you just drop them all into a pot, and you can cook them the way I learned to do in Italy, in just the water clinging to the greens. Or you can do what most traditional Maine cooks do, and you add some water to it, and you add a chunk of salt pork or even a chunk of bacon, and you cook them for several hours until they're really limp. I don't do that anymore because, A, I don't think you get the great flavor of the greens, and, B, I think a lot of the nutrition disappears when you cook them that long. So I tend to cook them until they're limp enough to be able to bite them without crunch, crunch, crunch.
But still longer than you might cook spinach.
Yes,
or,
indeed,
kale
a lot
or something
longer.
Like
yeah,
that. Okay. Okay, Don, bringing you into the conversation, you deal with these treasures, very old cookbooks that serve as documents of our past. How do we know what we know about food history? I mean, cookbooks are kind of relatively new, people who cooked like Sandy was describing weren't cooking from cookbooks.
For the most part, that's true. Cookbooks are relatively new, certainly in Maine's long history. The first cookbooks that we know of that were produced in Maine, both written in and printed in Maine, don't appear until the 1870s. And certainly there's a very long history before that. But we do have also manuscript cookbooks, cookbooks that were written by hand and kept by individual families.
You have those?
Oh, yes.
In the bookstore? Wow.
I have some. I collect Maine cookery specifically myself personally, not just as the shop. And so I have a number of those and a very, very large collection of early Maine cookbooks. But the they were also using, in Maine, they were using lots of cookbooks that went before. So it was very common to find books by Mrs. Raffold or Mrs. Rundle, which were two very, very popular English cookbooks that were either printed in England or printed in America later. That would be found in Maine households. So it's not just Maine cookbooks one would find, but other sources as well.
Right.
And, of course, cookbooks are only one of the many sources for food history. Beyond that, you have so many different things. You have menus, of course, and menus stretch back well earlier than cookbooks themselves. And the earliest Maine menus that we're aware of are 1830s.
When you say a menu, is this something maybe somebody wrote in their diary what they served to a guest, or is this a traditional restaurant menu?
They're traditional restaurant menus or banquet menus. Usually the very early ones for Maine in particular are banquet menus.
Mm.
And if you were to look only at Maine cookbooks or only at Maine menus and try to determine from those things what Maine food was, you'd have two entirely different visions of what Maine food was about.
Sure, because this was the fancy food that was maybe only eaten once in a while.
That's correct. It's a celebratory banquet food. It's certainly food that was being consumed by the well-to-do,
right?
Mostly in bigger centers like Portland, but other places as well. Whereas the cookbooks, and I think we should be grateful for this as historical sources, the cookbooks of Maine tend to be community, church, and charitable cookbooks.
Oh, right.
So they're the small, locally produced books. Doesn't mean the recipes are all local, but they were aware of these recipes locally and probably using them locally. And so that through those things, you get a much better vision of the specificity of place.
Okay, so I love the idea that you have old handwritten recipes. Have you tried to make any of them, and is there one that you have tried and you loved and isn't something we really eat today?
Well, for me, when I look at historical recipes, I'm really interested in what the recipe tells me about things like process and what it may not tell me about process. And by process, I mean like how are you actually creating this dish? What
are
the things
you're using?
Right,
because they made assumptions when they were making the recipes that everyone knew how to do this or that and didn't write it down, right?
There are assumptions of knowledge. There are also things that are left out because there was no way to determine those things.
Mm.
So, you know, there's no gas mark 7 or 250 degrees because this was not, you know, the exact temperatures were not determined as one was going about cooking.
They would say put it in a hot oven or put it in a dying oven or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Moderate.
Yeah. And so we'd have to think what would that equivocate to today? Yeah. Yes.
Can I interject just one thing? I just learned from Google this morning when I opened up my Google page that today is the 310th anniversary of the birth of Hannah Glass, whom Don mentioned earlier, who wrote this great cookbook that was used throughout the British Isles and also throughout the American colonies, North and South both.
And what were you
and
saying?
And in Maine, the Gardner family who settled Gardner, she had a manuscript cookbook, and most of the recipes in it were copied straight from Hannah Glass.
So I wanted to ask you, Sandy, what would be different between what's in Hannah Glass's cookbook and then once she comes to Maine? And I'm sure the same ingredients aren't quite available to her, but maybe some ingredients, I'm thinking about corn, are available to her in Maine. So how do the recipes change?
One of the things that I find a lot of people did when they came here was adapt familiar home recipes with the new ingredients. So they would look at the new ingredient and they would say, well, you know, how does this, when I cook with this, what does it remind me of that I used at home? And then they would just try to adapt the recipe, incorporating an old way of doing things, their old familiar way of doing things with this new dish. What's a good example of that?
Beans. Well, very beans, good example.
Yeah. Peas. The pea because tradition they had... becomes a bean tradition. Mm.
Oh, okay. Something you made peas about. So I want to ask you the same question I asked Don and Nancy. I'm going to ask you the same one. Do you have a favorite old recipe that you've successfully made that maybe isn't something you'd make today?
A dozen of them. I mean, a dozen.
Okay, tell me a couple.
Well, one that's maybe a little more recent than, say, colonial era, but there's a dish in Maine, probably earlier 20th century, maybe late 19th, called bean swagen.
It's a bean swagen.
Bean swagen, and it's made with the same kinds of beans that you make your baked beans with. You have salt pork and onion and beans, and you cook them all up until they start to cook apart, and then you add milk, and it's just delicious.
Ha! Huh.
Especially use evaporated milk. Really,
I thought you didn't use cans, Sandy.
Evaporated milk's different, Nancy.
Your exception. So, Sandy, is there a written recipe that we could post on our Facebook page for bean swagen, or just?
Yeah, I could give you a recipe for that.
Yeah.
Sure,
because it doesn't sound delicious, but I believe you.
Yeah.
And what about you, Nancy?
A dish that I like to make over and over again. I like to make baked beans. I think I'm the last person in Maine who makes baked beans on Saturday night.
No,
and I don't make them every Saturday night because I have a hard time finding people to eat them.
So
but
the
I want to tell you, when I went to Gould Academy in the 1950s, we had baked beans every Saturday night, and we had them warmed over for breakfast on Sunday morning.
And you didn't get tired of them?
No, I love them.
So are the baked beans that when we're talking about Maine's food heritage, the baked beans of 100, 200 years ago, the same as today, or are there...
Well, it depends on the recipe, obviously. Uh-huh. Today's recipes tend to get sweeter and sweeter to the point where you really don't want... I mean, most of the time when I look at a bean recipe, I just cut the sweetening in half. That's true of an awful lot of heritage recipes, by the way. Don't you think, Sandy?
Yeah, I do.
They just get sweeter. Oh. Cornbread is another good example. People start adding sugar to cornbread, and pretty soon what you've got is more of a cake than a bread.
And the baked beans you could eat for dessert.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But so you go to a baked bean supper around here, and they're hideously sweet sometimes. You're right, you could eat them for dessert. But the traditional, the old-fashioned way, yes, they always put sweetener in it, but it was molasses or maple syrup or I guess sometimes brown sugar or maple sugar.
But
not a lot, just enough to bring out the flavor of the beans. In the same way that adding a little sugar to a tomato sauce will bring out the flavor of the tomatoes.
Yeah. Don, before we go to a break, I want to ask you about certain people who help shape Maine food culture. Chefs, farmers, scientists, anyone you believe ought to be better known for their contributions.
Individuals. I'd like to look at somebody very, very early in Maine history, an English gentleman named John Josselyn, who came twice to New England, spent a lot of time in Maine. He apparently had a brother, Henry, who lived in Black Point in Scarborough. And when he visited twice in 1638 and 1663. And his book was published in 1663. And it's called New England Rarities. And it was basically a survey of the natural history of New England with an eye towards what's useful. And he landed in Boston and then went up to visit his brother and then walked all the way up into the White Mountains in New Hampshire, down through around Sebago Lake, through the Portland area, and back to Scarborough, and recorded everything he saw that he might think of as that would be thought of as useful. And useful means good for household use, good for industrial use, you know, timber for shipbuilding, good for cookery, and good for medicine. And the things he lists really, it speaks of the bounty of Maine at that very moment and how it was recognized by the English, certainly as some place that was going to produce valuable things to be extracted. That was part of it. But Josselyn really, he saw it all with a very sort of kind and generous eye in terms of a beautiful place that was filled with marvelous things that need to be cherished. And that, for a very early natural history book like that, I find it very special.
All right. Well, we do need to take a quick break. We're talking about Maine's food heritage. We'd love to hear about traditional foods that you still eat in your family or good stories that come from your grandparents about food. So when we come back, your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Nancy Marshall Communications, a Maine-based public relations firm with global reach, working to connect businesses and profits with their targeted audiences, and the Wonder Foundation, in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, always free and open to the public.
The giant squid is a mysterious deep-sea creature.
It's thought that there are actually millions of them in the ocean.
But before Edith Witter's 2012 expedition, no one had ever filmed it.
Oh, my God!
It was the most thrilling moment why many of us become scientists. It's just that moment of discovery.
I'm Guy Raz, in search of, next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us for the TED Radio Hour later this evening at 11 o'clock on Maine Public Radio. Tonight is Science Night on Maine Public Television. At 8 o'clock, we bring you Nature with an episode called Leave It to the Beavers. Then at 9 o'clock, it's Nova on The Great Math Mystery. It's a show for everyone. Whether we think we're good with numbers or not, we all use math in our daily lives. The Great Math Mystery sheds light on how math works in our brains and considers the ultimate mystery of why it works so well when decoding the universe. It's 2 hours of science, tonight at 8 on Maine Public Television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, exploring Maine's food heritage. And yes, I am hungry right now. I'm sure you are too. In the studio with me, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who is a cookbook author and food journalist. Don Lindgren owns Rabelais, an antiquarian bookstore focusing on food and drink. And that's in Biddeford, right, Don?
Yes.
Yeah. And Sandy Oliver, food writer and historian and columnist for the Bangor Daily News. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Also, go visit our Facebook page or our webpage today. We have something very special for you. Our guest Nancy Harmon Jenkins is showing us. It's a video, how to make Maine maple bread pudding. I got that right, Nancy?
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to go first to an email from Lynn. She has given us a quote from the introduction to Robert P. Tristram Coffin's Maine Cooking Old Time Secrets, written by Carol F. Terrell. And this is a quote. He, Coffin, was a charming teacher. Sitting at a classroom desk, he looked a tad like Oliver Hardy disguised by a big walrus mustaches. While he talked to us, he'd twirl first his right mustache, then the left. The more excited he got, the faster he'd twirl. But he didn't really wax poetic until he got to food. Then he let it all hang out and twirled with abandon because Professor Coffin loved to eat. His substantial girth suggested it, but his enthusiasm for old-time Maine cooking proved it. As he talked about sunlit fish chowder or Maine lobster and corn steamed in a seaweed and butter-dripping clam bake, he'd lick and smack his lips until he had his audience licking and smacking theirs. So thank you, Lynn, from Bristol, for sending that in. So that's another name to remember. Robert P. Tristram Coffin.
Author of Mainstays of Maine.
Mainstays of Maine. Okay. And Nancy.
And also Transcendental Boiled Dinner.
Transcendental Boiled Dinner. That seems like an oxymoron.
It does.
So, Nancy, who else would you like to have us remember?
Well, it's not a question of remembering. It's a question of honoring somebody who's very much with us now. And that is Chef Sam Hayward, who is now, he says he's retired, but it's hard to believe. But he was always the chef, the executive chef at 4th Street in Portland, and before that, many other restaurants in Maine. But I think Sam has done more than almost any other single person, with the possible exception of the late Russell Libby of Mofka, to stir up this feeling that we have something very special and very precious here, and we have to cherish it, and we have to bring it into the open, and we have to celebrate it. So that, for me, is a person fully as important as Jocelyn and, you know, other people that we might mention. Sam Hayward.
And a regular guest on Maine
yes,
Calling.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
One of our favorite people. We're going to go to Carrie, who's calling Final Haven. Hi, Carrie. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer, and hi, Nancy, and hi, Sandy.
Hi there.
Hi, Dawn.
What are you doing out there, Carrie?
I'm at work, but I'm playing hooky right now.
Good.
So I would, first of all, I was delighted to hear Don mention John Josselyn, because one of the famous, or not famous, but one line that really stuck with me from Josselyn was when he said, "I never ate better eels than I did in Maine." Mm. And that's actually one of the foods I wanted to talk about, because even though our modern sensibilities don't really incline towards eel, there was a time when all New Englanders really did, and it was a hugely important food. And I mention it only because we'll be talking about them in the past tense if we don't, you know, treat the resource with a little respect and stop doing things like netting as many baby eels as we can and sending them off to Japan to be turned into food rather than keeping them in our own ecosystem. And I think along with eels, as we see the ocean warming a bit, it could be that the heyday for oysters in Maine is yet to come. But, you know, there's a mixed bag in terms of our success stories, because for every resource that we've, you know, done some stewardship of, such as lobsters, there seem to be five or six that we have just harvested until there are no more.
Yeah, well, Carrie, thanks so much for calling in. Sandy, you were raising the roof when Carrie called in.
Yes. Carrie Hardy is an author of a wonderful book that tells an awful lot about the Native American food ways, and that is, his book is Notes on a Lost Flute, and it's a wonderful read.
Well, Carrie, thanks for... Don, did you want to say something?
No, I completely agree. I just wanted to add that the... the original question you started with had something to do with, like, what's the evidence? And when you think about some of these foodstuffs, like oysters, there's, like, physical evidence as well as all of the other stuff. And I just thought it important to mention that the importance of a foodstuff like oysters is can be seen in the land of Maine. Mm. It's something that you can literally drive by and notice. And I feel very strongly that Maine is one of the only states that you can drive in and see not a single or two pieces of evidence of its food culture and food history, but you're constantly surrounded by it, by the types of trees by the side of the road, by the types of stone walls and where they're placed, by the types of buildings, by oyster mounds, by the by old lobster shacks at the seashore, et cetera. So it's the food history is written in the land for us to see.
Carrie, thanks so much for calling in. We have Tamara. My husband's grandma, Dot Jorgensen, used to take the family bean pot to the baker's on Saturday, and that's why they'd have beans on Saturdays. Apparently, that was the tradition for everyone. Go ahead.
Yeah. Traditionally, Saturday was baking day in all of New England. And so people were baking bread and pies and putting custards in the oven, and beans would go in as the oven's temperature was beginning to drop away, but it would use up the last bits of the heat for a long time, a good, slow, long bake.
There's also, I think, in Puritan times, there's a connection with the religious prohibition of doing too much work from the beginning of the Sabbath on in Christianity.
So you'd wake up and your beans
Saturday
would be
night.
Ready.
Yeah.
And they'd still be warm, just a little warm.
Yeah, and you'd have food for the next day as well.
Elaine on Facebook asks, can someone clear up a Maine food mystery for me? I grew up in Saco and enjoyed eating clam cakes at local takeouts throughout York County. Since college, I have lived in the Midcoast area and down east, where not one single takeout restaurant serves them. Why?
Probably they're an import from Massachusetts, actually.
Oh, I'm sorry for your answer, Lane.
I just made that up.
But, okay.
But it's true. I've never heard of them, and I grew up in the Midcoast, and I've never heard of clam cakes. As something that you would find regularly in a shack somewhere.
All right. So,
clam chowder.
Oh, clams. Plenty of clams,
yeah,
but not clam cakes.
Clam cakes.
Fried clams. Fried clams, whole belly clams. I never knew they were called whole belly clams until I went away and discovered that that's what we eat here. I just called them clams.
We'll go to Brett, who's calling from Sullivan. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer and everybody. Thanks for having this conversation. I'm actually going to follow up Carrie. His comment about eels is really pretty timely for all kinds of river fish that people would have been eating around here kind of pre-colonization on. Tommy cod around Christmas and smelt and alewives. And I work with a group down in Columbia Falls where you can still harvest things like smelt and alewives We have a big feed that goes on, a big smelt fry, and that's this year on April 21st, 11 to 4 in downtown Columbia Falls. And we invite
people
to come and join us and come and feed on smelts and bloaters and things like that.
And Brett, I invite you to go onto the Maine Calling Facebook page and put more information about it. You don't even have to be a Facebook member. Just go to mainecalling.com/Facebook and add some. Thanks. We'll go to an email from Jessica. My grandmother and mother had this little paper Maine recipe cookbook. Our favorite recipe was a seafood casserole. It was with scallops, haddock, shrimp, lobster. You would add cream of shrimp soup, and it had a Ritz cracker butter crust on top. We were not rich growing up, so it was a special treat to get crab. My mom would always get hot dog rolls that she would toast, and she always had to have plain chips and chocolate milk with our crab meat rolls. These are two of my favorite childhood meals. Thanks for sharing that, Jessica. You guys want to share some favorite childhood meals?
That sounds like something my mother might have made, actually. Yeah, I'll tell you my least favorite childhood meal. It was very Maine. It was a Spam casserole. I'm not going to give you the recipe for that. I've lost it.
What about you, Don?
I didn't grow up in Maine, so I didn't have the good fortune of having this food culture. And frankly, didn't grow up in a family that had a really any specific food culture that I could celebrate. That's why I'm so engaged by it now, and I'm so happy to be surrounded by good food.
Mm.
One thing I would point out, based on the recipe that Jessica shared there, is that the idea that one would add commercial products, Ritz crackers, or a can of soup, or condensed milk, or something to a recipe. We seem to be moving away from that, but there was a moment where those things were really desirable, where they were considered a move forward, some sort
sure.
of progress, a little bit aspirational even. Mm-hmm. So it's not something to be derided when you see that in a cookbook. It's something to be, you know, just wonder why it's there and try it sometimes.
And they were also products that you could keep in the pantry for whatever occasion came up. You know, if your mother-in-law suddenly arrived for dinner, you could whip out a can of creamed shrimp, whatever, and
right.
make a great casserole for her.
Mm-hmm. Sandy, what about you? Favorite childhood food?
Well, like Dawn, I'm from away, but I married a Maine boy. And his recollection of coming home from school to an after-school snack of bread spread with butter with a little molasses spread on it sounds really wonderful to me, and it speaks to the popularity of molasses that lasted a long time in Maine, long after sugar replaced it elsewhere.
We'll go to Karen, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Karen. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for the show. I love it, and sometimes I listen twice.
Oh, thank you.
Something interesting. I have, well, kind of a mystery, but my favorite comfort food is something, most people call it shepherd's pie, and it's just meat, hamburg, usually a cheap cut of hamburg, and corn in the middle, and potatoes, mashed potatoes on top that you brown under the broiler. But we always called it Chinese pie, and I don't know if that was just a family thing. I grew up in central Maine, and my father's family, I think, called it Chinese pie, and so we all call it Chinese pie. And I just wonder if that's unique, or if it's a regional thing, or where that came from.
Oh, I think it probably is unique to your family, Karen, but it sounds wonderful. It reminds me, again, I keep being reminded of what my mother used to make. She made something she called American chop suey, and it had nothing to do with Chinese food at all. It was basically, it was pasta, usually elbow macaroni, and ground meat and tomato sauce. And it was an Italian recipe, but she called it American chop suey, and that made it okay.
Karen, thanks so much for calling in and sharing that. An email from Deborah. I remember going up to camp, Green Lake near Ellsworth, and my grandparents would give me Moxie and chocolate donuts for my breakfast, much to the horror of my health-conscious mother. We also used to love to go into Bar Harbor and get Bar Harbor bars, but the details are fuzzy. Do your guests know more?
Bar Harbor bars. We were talking about Needham's earlier. I wonder if they're related to Needham's. Mm.
Well, there you go, Deborah. You stumped them.
Yeah.
And this is a good panel.
I like the phrase up to camp, though. That's a very Maine phrase.
And that's something else about Maine that's really marvelous, is that it has so many different types of environments for food to develop in. It has small cities. It has the seashore. It has camp. All of these things have their own pressures that help to shape the way food is. Camp food is different from seashore food. Mm. You know, city food is different from farm food.
Chocolate donuts and moxie for breakfast.
That's. I have a friend from Central Maine, and bean whole beans were camp food. That was a big tradition every summer at camp. You all are all nodding. So guess what? We have to go to a break already again. When we come back, more talk about Maine's food heritage. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As do Maine Community Foundation, celebrating 35 years of investing in Maine communities. Learn more at mainecf.org. And the University of Maine's Framing Maine series, presenting an evening of song and story with David Mallett, April 7th. Tickets at framingmaine.com.
50 years ago, black sanitation workers in Memphis went on strike. Their rallying cry, "I am a man."
The phrase, "I am a man," signifies dignity. It was, I want to be treated like a man.
Activists in Memphis today say they are still fighting for dignity. I'm Ari Shapiro, Memphis 50 years later, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio. Stay with us at 2 o'clock for the Commonwealth Club of California. On today's show, Professor of Law at the Yale Law School, Amy Chua, author of Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother. She discusses political tribalism, which she says threatens to tear our country apart. That's on the Commonwealth Club of California in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the role of food in Maine's culture, economy, and heritage. In the studio with me, Don Lindgren. He owns Rabelais, selling antiquarian books on food and drink. It's in Biddeford. Sandy Oliver, who is a food writer and historian. You can read her in the Bangor Daily News. And Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who's a cookbook author and food historian. You can also see Nancy teach us how to make Maine maple bread pudding, yum, on our Facebook page and on our webpage. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Waterville and Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi. You know, this is a great show. I really love it because I love cooking and experimenting. Nobody has mentioned Indian pudding.
Mm.
And, of course, it's made with cornmeal mush, custard, sweetened with molasses and warmed with spice, and you cook it for 3 hours in the oven in a pan of hot water. I haven't made it, but my mother made it all the time. The other thing I wanted to mention was that when my daughter went away to school, she had never had quiche. She was introduced to quiche and brought it home to me. Her friends had never had boiled dinner. She made a boiled dinner for them. They didn't care for it too much, but I love the quiche.
An unfair trade. Marilyn, thanks so much for calling. And Sandy, you were nodding when she was saying how to make the Indian bread pudding, the Indian pudding.
Yes. Well, we were talking earlier about what, you know, how did newcomers adapt ingredients. Indian pudding is a really, really good example of that. It's descended in a family of what were called milk puddings, which came over here from England and in England. It was thickened with farina, which is wheat, but you could take your ground cornmeal and mix it into the milk and bake it with the sweetening of molasses, which was an inexpensive sweetener, and put it in the oven along with the baked beans on a long, low, slow bake, and that's
Sandy, why was it called Indian pudding? Did the Indians make it?
The Indians did not make Indian pudding. We used to call cornmeal Indian meal. It was named, it was their maize was their grain. The word corn was a generic word for grain.
Hmm.
So Indian corn.
Interesting. And I know that there's another Maine food myth that you'd like to dispel, Sandy, something to do with lobster.
Sure.
I've heard what you're going to say, this is interesting to me. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, one of the first things I heard when I moved to Maine was, the prisoners over at the Thomaston Penitentiary refused to eat lobster more than twice a week. And I thought, oh boy, here we go again. This myth is pretty
pretty common, and I've heard it applied to all kinds of things. Apprentice in Boston during the, you know, the colonial era, and you know, the poor people in any given poor house, and you know, all about it. Well, I'll give you the punchline because we don't have a lot of time. Before 1900, this same story was told about salmon, not lobsters. And if you look back into the record, you'll find that the stories weren't even true about salmon either. Salmon at the end of the towards the end of the 1800s was starting to be a really valuable fish. It was a little less common, less easy to catch. It becomes elevated in our imaginations, and people started talking about how, those stupid people years ago didn't know enough to eat it when it was so wonderful. And then we just switched over to lobster. We started talking about lobster the same
Isn't
way.
Isn't that funny?
On the other hand.
Yes.
On the other hand. I was having, on the other hand, of Sandy's recollections. My mother, born in Thomaston in 1907, used to say when I complained about what the food that was put in front of me, we were so poor when I was growing up, child, that we had nothing to eat in the winter but saltfish and lobster.
But there's a good reason for that, and that is that lobster can be subsistence fare. If you don't have a market for it, it's pretty worthless stuff. Mm. So what are you going to do with it? Eat it.
Don?
Yeah, something that grew out of that, and some other things like lobster being available in a canned form, which was very common. And you see this in cookbooks. If you look at cookbooks from, say, the 1890s through the 1940s, you'll frequently find 10 and even more. I've seen as many as 30 recipes for lobster. And we think that lobster is fairly limited, or I think most people think that lobster is fairly limited to, you know, your boiled or steamed lobster, your lobster rolls. Nowadays, people are doing things like lobster mac and cheese, but they don't have a whole range of things they do on a weekly basis. And they used to. And I think it's very interesting to see how we've now reduced it to a much narrower range. And I wish that we would open it up and see it as a great basic protein, because then it would be more of our ordinary eating, and perhaps we would need to export less of it in order to keep the fishery healthy.
This idea of canned lobster I was first introduced to this morning when I stopped by the exhibit at the Maine Historical Society. Has any of you ever tasted it? Because it does not sound good to me.
Oh, I have.
Is it?
Yeah. And I mean, there are canned lobster. There aren't very many people producing canned lobster anymore, but mostly in Asia. But there's some marvelous things. Like there's a smoked canned lobster that's absolutely delicious. It's very simple. You can actually make it at home if you have a small smoker. But the lobster and oysters both show up in every cookbook across the nation. If you look at cookbooks in Wyoming and Oklahoma.
Interesting.
And they show up both in the canned form and the live form. And
wow.
That's what's really interesting, is that they were shipping these, you know, live lobsters in barrels of ice on trains by the 1880s and 1890s.
That is really interesting. We'll go to John calling from Wyndham. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi there. So I am a fisherman, and I enjoy eating what I catch. I love brook trout and other kind of like staple fish like that. I also like some of the fish that you don't really think about eating, like perch. So just wondering if there were any traditional recipes that are passed down by anglers for basically eating fish that you might catch. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, John.
Pan fried. Put a little bacon, yeah. Put a little salt pork in a pan.
Salt
cook it
pork.
Up and
dice the salt pork first.
Salt pork. Yep.
Fry it to bring out all the fat until you get little scrunchions of salt pork. Then take the scrunchions out. Put the dip it first in a little cornmeal. Mm-hmm. Put it in the pan and fry it on both sides. Add the scrunchions back when you serve it.
Well, there you go.
Easy peasy.
I'm going to read a couple tweets quickly. This is one's from Ari. I'm out in the field working for the Maine Department of Marine Resources, monitoring shellfish such as mussels and softshell clams for biotoxins, such vital resources for Maine's economy and food heritage. Another tweet here from Jenny. Well, not unique to Maine, fresh local dairy is such an important and nutritious and delicious part of our economic landscape and heritage. Dairy farmers continue to be the engine of our communities. Also, such good cheese, ice cream, gelato, milk, and more. And Nancy, I know I'm really surprised you haven't shouted out eggs yet.
Oh, eggs. I love eggs. I live on eggs and tomatoes in the summertime and eggs and oranges in the winter. Oranges are not from Maine, alas.
I'm going to go to Ann, who's calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm new to Maine, so I'm just learning the food, but I wanted to comment on adding the prepared materials to traditional dishes. And in my tradition, we have a noodle pudding that's very traditional. And if you look at the cookbooks, you know, over the turn of the century towards mid-century, you see corn flakes being added as a topping, and that makes it American. So Maine doesn't have to worry about making their food American, but that was another reason, I think, for using those things. And I just want to give a shout-out to the Mount Desert Island Historical Society and their baked bean dinner, which can give you a full range of traditional baked bean dishes and, you know, Maine innovative baked bean dishes, and also picking blueberries in Acadia National Park. They let you do that. And there's nothing like hiking up a mountain and picking Maine wild blueberries as you go. So thank you.
Ann, thanks for your call. Go ahead, Don.
One of the reasons that things like cornflakes or any popular American ingredient started to be incorporated into other recipes is that they produced literally tens of thousands of product cookbooks, some quite elaborate, others very simple. But it was a really effective way of putting the name of their product into a household was to produce a book because people would keep it. They'd keep it in the kitchen, and they'd refer to it. And, of course, every recipe in that book contained the ingredient that was being advertised. So an entire recipe of – an entire book of cornflake recipes. And many of them were perfectly tasty.
Oh, I'm sure, because they'd been tested in the test kitchens. That's
yes.
Right, Nancy.
I just want to put a quick shout out here before we have to close off, because one of the ways that we preserve our food heritage is by preserving the actual seeds that create the vegetables. And there are two projects in Maine in particular that I think should be mentioned. I hope we can put them up on the website. One is the Madonoc Valley High School Seed Saving Project, which has been going on since 1972, believe it or not. And they have more than 800 varieties. Neil Lash at the school is the head of that, and it is a great program. I wish every high school in the state would have it. And the other is Will Bonsall, who has been very involved with MAFCA and with the Skowhegan Grain Project and all of that. And he has something called the Scatter Seed Project, which similarly saves disappearing varieties and preserves them for future generations. So those two, they're part of our heritage.
We have Deborah on Facebook saying, how about Wiggle? My father was horrified that my mother from New Jersey didn't know how to make this dish when they got married. Sandy, you're laughing.
Yeah, I am. Nancy and I were talking about Wiggles earlier. She had used to eat salmon and pea wiggle, right?
Shrimp pea wiggle. Shrimp. That's what my mother
shrimp
made.
Right. Shrimp is more often a wiggle than, yes. That's delicious stuff if you like it.
I hated it.
What? What is it?
It's cream sauce with shrimp in it
and
peas.
And it's sometimes it's baked in the oven. I mean, there were certain things my mother cooked that I thought were detestable. But
you serve it on toast or mashed potatoes.
She just served it in the plate, in a white plate, white sauce on a white plate.
We're going to go to Cushing and Luke. Hi, Luke. Go ahead.
Yes. I kind of have a question about a recipe that was handed down to me via my grandparents, just word of mouth. It's a local dish here on the coast. It's poached fish served on top of mashed potatoes. Often served with either a poached egg and salt pork fried. But, of course, I didn't have a recipe to go by, so I use cusk, which I put in the crock pot to poach all day. I just use thick slab bacon, and I made a crab hollandaise sauce go on top of all of that. And I was just wondering if that dish even has a name, a recipe that I could find to make it a little more classic.
I don't think it has a name, but it certainly sounds like a long tradition of salt cod dinners, which are just it's boiled salt cod or cooked salt cod with a cream sauce or, the fried bits of salt pork that Nancy was talking about earlier, or egg.
And everything that's in the ingredient list you mentioned there is available in February.
Mm-hmm.
Or March. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are. Yep. It's one of the things when you look at a dish, you can sort of begin to determine its seasonality. Is it something that I could eat if I were a farmer in in 1870 in Maine.
Beyond that is something you wouldn't want to eat in August.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have any appeal at all in August.
Uh-huh. Well, Luke, thanks for calling in. I have an email from Mark. We retired to Maine and so far have found chanterelles, porcini, hedgehog, and lobster mushrooms. Mm. On our property in Exeter, we have fiddleheads, old apple trees, five types of berries. And as I write this note, I'm doing my third maple sap boil of the season. Tapped only 10 sugar maple trees, and we have 4 gallons of liquid gold to give to family and friends. This state is a forager's dream.
Foraging, yeah, it is a forager's dream. And foraging was a subsistence strategy. So we continue it honorably. Mind you, if you were busy with a farm, you couldn't be spending a lot of time wandering around in the woods looking for food. So it was very often a recreational activity. There's a diary of a young man up in Augusta. On Sundays, he used to go out and look for strawberries or blueberries.
All right, so I'm going to go quickly to an email from Thorndike, someone from the town. Thorndike, will be celebrating our 200th anniversary next year. What would have been in the gardens then that we don't plant now? What would have been served in a meal then would have been uncommon to us now?
Well, I'll tell you what would not be there. You wouldn't have mussels. You wouldn't have mussels. You wouldn't have swordfish. You probably wouldn't have wrinkles. You would not have the kind of good bread that we have now. You wouldn't have calamari. You wouldn't have sushi or sashimi.
And you wouldn't have jalapeno peppers either.
No, and you wouldn't have probably wouldn't have things cooked in a tomato sauce.
Mm-hmm. You wouldn't have pasta.
Yeah.
So, but would you? And it's not that we don't grow pumpkins now, but people ate a lot more of that kind of thing, didn't
right.
they?
A lot of squashes and things like that. Yeah. I think if you want to know what people ate, then the best place to go is to Martha Ballard. And you don't want to read her whole diaries because it's hard to do, but you read Laurel Thatcher Ulrich's A Midwife's Tale. And it's the story of a woman on the banks of the Kennebec River in the late 18th and very early 19th century. What she planted in her garden, what she ate, what she fed people. No recipes, but a lot of food information.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. And it's going to be our last one. I just made the mistake of looking at the clock and we're out of time. So I want to thank my guests and be sure and look on our Facebook page and our webpage. We're going to post all sorts of resources, including the terrific video of Nancy. So our guest today, Sandy Oliver, a food writer and historian. She writes the Taste Buds column for the Bangor Daily News. Don Lindgren, the proprietor of Rabelais, an antiquarian bookstore in Biddeford that specializes in food and drink. And Nancy Harmon Jenkins, an award-winning cookbook author and food historian. You can see her in action demonstrating how to cook maple bread pudding by visiting our website or Facebook page. And don't forget about the second annual Maine Public Create It Maine Recipe Contest. Participating is really easy. The winner receives $250, and there are 4 runner-up prizes. All you need to do is create a spectacular dessert where a Maine ingredient is the hero. The more imaginative, the better. Visit the Maine Public website, mainepublic.org, for details, but act fast. The deadline for entries, April 13th. Roddy Nick Bohr ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, what to do if wildlife gets a little too close for comfort. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.